Okay, thanks. And let's see, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to join this program. Okay, so what I'm going to do is to tell you about critical gravitational collapse of a massive vector field. This work is now on GRQC, and this is done in collaboration with Robert Mann at Waterloo and Chris Vui at Embry-Riddle. So what I'm going to do is the following. I'm going to start by reminding you about critical gravitational collapse. Then I'm going to tell you about some work done by Pat Brady and his collaborators on the critical collapse of a massive scalar field. And looking closely at this, it turns out that if you ask yourself what happens in the critical gravitational collapse of a massive vector field, you get into a kind of paradox. That is, you have a perfectly reasonable argument that leads you to expect one outcome and another perfectly reasonable argument that leads you to expect the exact opposite. And so in order to resolve this paradox, we ran a bunch of simulations. And then what I'll do is I'll tell you what the results of our simulations are and at the end resolve the paradox.
Will any special symmetry?
Yes, spherical symmetry, right. So there's a lot of axisymmetric critical gravitational collapse. There is so far, except for Karsten's perturbative result, no critical gravitational collapse in the absence of symmetry. And almost all of the work in critical collapse is done in spherical symmetry. And in fact, this paradox, as you'll see later, arises precisely because of spherical symmetry. Okay, so let me start by reminding you of the basics of critical gravitational collapse, and in particular, since this field is about a decade old, I'll remind you of the stuff that Matt did 10 years ago to get this thing started. So the idea is the following. What one wants to study is essentially the threshold of black hole formation. So usually for reactions, we figure there's an energy threshold. If you get too small an energy, the reaction doesn't take place. If you get a large enough energy, the reaction does take place. For gravitational collapse, it's really more of an energy compactification threshold. If you get enough energy compacted into a small enough space, you form a black hole. If you don't have enough energy, you don't get a black hole. And so in particular, there's the question of what happens if you have some type of matter field for which the only possibilities are dispersal or black hole formation, such as a massless scalar field. So then the idea is you imagine a one-parameter family of initial data for that system, and you can think of this parameter as being the initial amplitude of the scalar field. For small amplitude, gravity is always weak, and the field eventually disperses. For large amplitude, gravity gets strong and a black hole forms, and somewhere in between there must be a critical amplitude, P star, that's just barely at the threshold of black hole formation. And then the question is, what happens at and near the threshold of black hole formation, and in particular, is there a mass gap? Does black hole formation turn on with a finite mass? So Matt answered this question a decade ago, and what you find is that there's no mass gap. At the threshold of black hole formation, you turn on with a zero mass black hole, and near the threshold, you form black hole masses that obey this power law. Black hole mass goes like parameter minus critical parameter to a power gamma, where gamma is universal in the sense that it doesn't depend on which family of initial data you choose, but not quite universal in the sense that it does depend on which kind of matter field you're dealing with. And numerically, gamma is found to be about 0.374. Okay, so in addition to this stuff about what happens near the threshold of black hole formation, you can ask the question, what happens exactly at the threshold of black hole formation? And Matt found that also. And if you sit exactly at the P equals P star initial data and evolve it, you find that what you get is something that is discretely self-similar. That is, in mathematical terms, there's an isometry that leaves the scalar field alone and takes the metric into a multiple of itself. Or in physical terms, what happens is, as the scalar field collapses, most of it disperses, and then what you have left is essentially the same profile, but with the scale of space shrunk, and then that whole thing proceeds, most of that collapses, and then finally you get an infinite number of collapses in a finite amount of time, and you form a zero mass naked singularity. Okay, so this is what happens in the case of the critical collapse of a massless scalar field. So now what you might want to know is what happens for other matter fields. And in particular, you might wonder about this property of self-similarity. So we know that for the vacuum Einstein equations, and also for the Einstein scalar equations, they have the property of scale invariance. That is, for the Einstein scalar equations, if you have a solution and you leave the scalar field alone and multiply the metric by a constant, that's still a solution. So because these things have the property of scale invariance, it's fairly natural that solutions should have the property of self-similarity. So in other words, these discretely self-similar solutions for a scale invariant theory look a lot like limit cycles in ordinary dynamical systems. And continuously self-similar solutions, which one also gets in other types of critical collapse, sort of look like limit points. So this sort of odd property of self-similarity is not so odd when you consider that the system that you're studying has scale invariance. But now you might ask the question, what happens if we break scale invariance? So the original critical collapse simulations were done with a system that has scale invariance. Now suppose we break scale invariance by choosing a different kind of matter field. So in particular, suppose that we take a spherically symmetric scalar field, but now we give it a mass instead of considering the massless case. So now the mass introduces a length scale, that length scale breaks scale invariance, and then the question is what happens to critical collapse. So this issue was addressed by Patrick Brady and his collaborators, and they did a bunch of numerical simulations. And so what I'm going to tell you now is the results of those numerical simulations that that Pat Brady and his collaborators did. Okay, so the results of their numerical simulations are that now there are two critical solutions. So one is a periodic solution. It's not self-similar in any sense. It's usually called a type 1 critical collapse and is kind of analogous to things like, say, an unstable neutron star at the threshold of black hole formation. But I don't want to concentrate on that one. Rather, I want to concentrate on the fact that this system of a massive scalar field also has a critical solution that's identical to the one that you get in the massless case. So you added this mass parameter, it broke scale invariance, but nonetheless, you still have a critical solution that is scale invariant. And so you might ask the question, okay, what's going on here? Here we broke scale invariance, but we get it back in the critical solution. So how is that happening? Well, the answer, once you sort of look at the problem for a little bit, becomes fairly clear. If you look at the stress energy of a massive scalar field, what you find is that some of the terms depend on the amplitude of the scalar field, and other terms depend on the gradient of the scalar field. So the terms involving the mass only depend on the amplitude of the scalar field, and the other terms that don't depend on the mass involve the gradient. Now, in the critical solution, the amplitude of the scalar field is never getting very big, but because the scale of space on which things happen gets smaller and smaller, the gradients are getting enormous. So what's happening in the massive scalar field case is simply that the mass terms are becoming negligible, and the stress energy of the massive scalar field is becoming essentially the same as the stress energy of the massless scalar field. And so the mass terms don't make a difference, and you get exactly the same critical solution that you get in the massless case.
So the two solutions are identical in some long time limit?
That's right. I mean, well, it's long. Well, so if you choose as your time coordinate the logarithm of the time to the singularity, then in the long time limit they become identical. I mean, since the singularity happens at a finite amount of proper time, it's actually a short amount of real proper time. But yeah, it's basically a long time limit.
If they don't form a black hole, you're just below criticality, mm-hmm. and the massless one disperses to scry, and the massive one disperses to pi plus, right?
Basically.
A global difference between the limits. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. There's definitely a global difference. But when you're looking at the critical solution, you're just looking basically in the past light cone of the singularity, and there, as you approach the singularity, the mass doesn't make a difference. Okay. So now I've told you about some old stuff. Now, I want to introduce the paradox associated with the massive vector field. So some of you already know the resolution of this paradox, but for those of you who don't, I encourage you during the talk to think about what could the answer possibly be. Okay, so here is the paradox. We start with a nice simple sounding question. We've looked at now the collapse of a massive scalar field. Let's now do the same thing with a massive vector field. So we'll take spherical symmetry, we'll take a spherically symmetric massive vector field, and we'll look at its critical collapse. And the question is, what should we get? So the paradox comes in the following two simple arguments. The first thing that you should think of is the following. Well, gee, we just did this for the massive scalar field, and we found that the mass terms are negligible. Surely for the massive vector field, the same thing should happen. As we go to the critical solution, the mass should become negligible for exactly the same reasons. And so the critical collapse of a massless vector field should be, sorry, the critical collapse of a massive vector field should be the same as for a massless vector field. So this is sort of the first part of the paradox. Here's a perfectly reasonable argument that leads you to believe the mass should become negligible, and so what we should get is the same as for a massless vector field. Okay, now the second part of the argument, we're in spherical symmetry, and a massless vector field is the same as a Maxwell field. A Maxwell field in spherical symmetry has no degrees of freedom. Something with no degrees of freedom can't undergo any kind of gravitational collapse, let alone critical collapse. And so the critical collapse of a massive vector field cannot possibly be the same as the critical collapse of a massless vector field. So this is the paradox. We have an argument that leads us to believe one thing and an argument that leads us to believe exactly the opposite. And so the question is, what's the resolution? So again, maybe between now and the end of the talk, you'll figure out what the resolution is. We weren't smart enough to do it, and so we said, well, let's just run some numerical simulations and find out what the answer is.
I guess I don't see where the paradox even is. I mean, you haven't told us maybe a massless vector field behaves like a Maxwell field. I mean,
well, a massless vector field is a Maxwell field. But a massive vector field is sort of like a Maxwell field, but with some extra terms that depend on a mass.
It should behave like a massless vector field, which in turn is a Maxwell field, which is the second one. So that's why I'm having trouble seeing.
Oh, okay. The second one, we're in spherical symmetry. And in spherical symmetry, a Maxwell field does not have any degrees of freedom. And so if you say, let me study the critical collapse of a spherically symmetric Maxwell field, you won't get anything at all because nothing happens. And so the critical collapse of a massive vector field cannot, according to this argument, be the same as the critical collapse of a massless vector field because there's no such thing as the critical collapse of a massless vector field.
Okay, I still won't see the parallel. Go ahead.
Okay.
You're kind of assuming there is critical collapse in the mass E phase, and I guess we have.
Well, okay, so that would be one possible resolution of the paradox. Maybe you do simulations of a massive vector field and you find no critical collapse at all. I mean, that would be one possible resolution. And I mean there's no proof. But on the face of it, that sounds like a kind of implausible resolution, because after all, the massive vector field will be self-gravitating, and so for small enough amplitude we ought to get dispersal, and for large enough amplitude we ought to get black holes, and so there ought to be critical collapse. So what you say is a possible resolution, but it sort of sounds like an act of desperation. Well, you know, maybe there isn't any gravitational collapse at all. It sounds unlikely, but it's not logically impossible. And again, the idea was, well, let's run these simulations and see what happens. And so that was a good guess, but it turns out not to be the correct answer.
Matter too, by no degrees of freedom, it's absolutely zero. That's
the idea. There is no spherically symmetric, you know, non-singular, sourceless Maxwell field. Okay. So anyway, that was a good guess as to the resolution, but not the right one. Okay. So before I present the results, let me say a little bit about the numerical methods. So when you want to do a simulation, you want a code that's up to the task. We actually ended up writing three different codes. One, a sort of straightforward Cauchy code, which, you know, does a very good job of handling one of the solutions. One, a characteristic code, and then Matt lent us one of his codes that we modified to make a Cauchy code with AMR. Okay, so let me say a little bit about how each of these goes. Oh, adaptive mesh refinement. Okay, so for the Cauchy codes, you do the following. You write the spherically symmetric metric in this form, and so for the metric, you're finding these two functions, alpha and a, of t. Your initial data surface is all radii at a moment of time, so that's this blue slice, and then there's a special radius, this dotted line, that's r equals 0. The initial data for the vector field are basically the time and r components of the vector field. You can then solve a constraint to find out what the field strength of the vector field is. And there are other constraints that you can then solve to find the metric components. So given initial data, you can do a bunch of integrals to find all the matter fields and the metric fields. Now, given all the matter and metric fields, you can then use the field equations to evolve these data, and then you get to the next time steps. You evolve along these upgoing red lines to the next time step, and then you just repeat the process marching through, and you either find dispersal or a black hole. So Einstein's equations become a bunch of partial differential equations. For the spatial derivatives, we use center differences, and for time evolution, we use the iterated Crank-Nicholson method. And then to make the code stable, we add some dissipation. And then, so this is just the sort of, well, so this stuff up till now is actually properties of both codes, it turns out. But for the adaptive mesh refinement code, we took one of Matt's old codes that was used to do the Einstein-Yang-Mills collapse, and then just changed the equations of motion so it was doing massive vector field instead of Einstein-Yang-Mills.
I think I had to do all this work. I keep hearing the rabble about doing it. It was like cactus. Sort of put the equations in.
Well, okay, so. first of all, you want the code to work. You don't just want it to compile and run. But you want it to actually, you know, be stable and give the correct answer and things like that. So there are So cactus is basically something. So first of all, this is spherical symmetry, so you don't really need cactus. Cactus is something to do, you know, three-dimensional things with no symmetry at all. And the idea is they have a whole bunch of routines, and then you write your own routine that's sort of your version of Einstein's equation or whatever bells and whistles you want to add to it, and then you put it in. So that would not be appropriate for this sort of thing, because we're doing spherical symmetry rather than, you know, things with no symmetry at all. But even then, when you're doing critical collapse, it's not enough that you just, you know, have a code that runs. You want the code to run and be nice and stable and be very accurate. So for that, cactus wouldn't be appropriate. There is something actually sort of similar, which Matt invented, called RNPL, standing for Rapid Numerical Prototyping Language. And that actually is something along the lines of what you say. I mean, there what you do is tell it, here are the differential equations that I'm going to solve, and here is the numerical scheme that I want to use, and then it writes the code for you. And that's actually pretty good too. But it turns out that there is in fact there's something of a learning curve associated with learning how to use RNPL. And even then, I mean, when I use this to modify Matt's code to do the from the Einstein Yang Mills to this sort of thing, even then that particular version of the code was not quite robust enough to do all these things, and Matt had to fiddle with it some more to finally get it into shape. So in fact, it turns out that for something as simple as these spherically symmetric things, and we sort of demonstrated this to ourselves in this case, it really is just about as easy to write your own code from scratch as it is to, you know, use somebody else's codes or routines. Okay, so that's the Cauchy stuff. Let me tell you about the characteristic stuff. To write the code or to get it to work properly? to write the code, sort of a few days, and to get it to work properly, you know, on the order of a month. Okay, so now let me tell you about the characteristic code. So here, the idea is that instead of the initial data surface being space-like surface, the initial data surface is an outgoing light cone. And then what we do is, instead of evolving upwards in time, we evolve along ingoing light rays. So if you write the metric in the form that Christodoulou used for the scalar problem, what you find is that you have these, in addition to the area radius, you have this null coordinate u, which is constant along outgoing light cones, and you have these two metric functions. Initial data turns out to be just the radial derivative of r times a scalar field, where the derivative of the scalar field is the r coordinate of the vector field. It turns out that's all you need to give for data, and everything else you can just find from constraints. So integrating up the generators from this datum, you can produce all the rest of the components of the matter field and the metric field, and then the Einstein equations for this just become ordinary differential equations along these ingoing characteristics. Okay, so it turns out that when you evolve along ingoing light rays, what that means is that at some point the points along which you're evolving will cross the origin, and then they won't be part of the simulation anymore. So in these characteristic codes, what you do is in some sense you lose points, but you can put them back when half of them are lost, and that essentially provides you a sort of poor man's adaptive mesh refinement. What you can do if you arrange the outer boundary cleverly is to always have enough points to resolve the features that you're looking at. So this is, at least for these simple problems, a sort of mesh refinement without mesh refinement way of doing things. All right, now I'm going to tell you about the results. So it turns out that, as in the massive scalar field case, there are two critical solutions. One is periodic, and one has discrete self-similarity. And here's the interesting part. The DSS solution turns out to be identical to the Chop-Tuick solution for a massless scalar field. So not just identical in terms of the same scaling relations for mass, but identical in the sense that this scalar field phi, for which dr of phi is mass times the r component of the vector field, this scalar field is identical in the limit to the scalar field for critical gravitational collapse of a massless scalar field. So somehow, in ways that we'll get into a little bit later, the critical solution for a massive vector field is identical to the critical solution for a massless scalar field.
Did you say what mu was?
Mu is the mass of the vector field. Okay, so now let me show you some graphs, the results of the numerical simulation. So here's what we get if we tune in to the critical solution that's periodic. So this is the one that's not self-similar and has nothing to do with the massless case. So this is a picture of the time component of the vector field at the origin as a function of time. And so what we find, so there's this sort of high frequency oscillation that's basically just depends on the mass of the vector field. Things oscillate back and forth at a rate of e to the I m t, where m is the mass. But then superimposed on that, what we find is we settle down to something that's basically a periodic envelope. So this is the periodic critical solution. Now let's concentrate on the other case, the case where we get a discrete self-similar solution. So for discrete self-similarity, what you find is that there's a power law relation between distance from critical parameter and mass. So black hole mass goes like parameter minus critical parameter to some power. And so what that means is that if you take log of mass versus log of parameter minus critical parameter, what you get is a line. It turns out that, in fact, you don't exactly get a straight line. What you get is a straight line with a periodic wiggle, where the slope of the line is this value gamma, and the period of the wiggle is delta over 2 gamma, where delta is the parameter Karsten talked about yesterday. That's the period in of the discrete self-similarity. So you can take these points and fit them to a straight line with a periodic wiggle and read off the slope of the line and the period of the wiggle, and you find the same slope and the same period that you get in the massless scalar field case. You can also do this on the subcritical side. So now imagine that instead of just barely forming a black hole, we're just barely not forming a black hole. So then what happens is the scalar field collapses, curvature gets big, but eventually the scalar field turns around and it decides to disperse. So when that happens, there is some point in space-time at which the scalar curvature has its maximum. And so for each of these simulations where you just barely don't form a black hole, you can ask, what is the maximum value of the scalar curvature? Now, in relativity units, the black hole mass has units of length. the scalar curvature has units of length to the minus 2. It turns out that these scaling laws only depend on the dimension of the quantity that you're looking at and don't depend on whether you're subcritical or supercritical. You get scaling laws on both sides. So what that means is that if black hole mass goes like parameter minus critical parameter to the gamma, then maximum curvature should go like parameter minus critical parameter to the minus 2 gamma. So once again, we do a whole bunch of simulations. And for each of those simulations, we keep track of log of parameter, critical parameter minus parameter, and we find the maximum value of the scalar curvature, and we plot log of R max versus log of P star minus P. And once again, what we have is a straight line with a periodic wiggle, and we can fit this to slope of the line and period of the wiggle. And again, we find a slope of minus 2 gamma, where gamma is the one in the black hole case, and a period of delta over 2 gamma. Okay, so far what I've done is to show you comparisons having to do with the scaling of mass or of curvature. Now let me show you a direct comparison involving the scalar field itself. So here what we have are basically two simulations. The solid line is what you get for critical collapse of a massless scalar field, and what's being plotted is the scalar field at the origin as a function of logarithm of time to the singularity. And so what you get is things slosh around for a while and then they approach something periodic. For the massive vector field, what you get is something that sloshes around in a different way, but then after a while it just tracks the other one. So this is a detailed comparison that shows that indeed the critical solution for the massive vector field is the same as the critical solution for the massless scalar field. Right, so the r derivative of phi is equal to the r component of the vector field.
So you've integrated that to get some effective scalar field?
Well, so this is a result of the characteristic code, and in the characteristic code, the idea is that you just rewrite the equations in terms of this effective scalar field anyway. So this is really the variable that the field is evolving, and the components of the matter fields are actually given by derivatives and integrals of that thing. Yeah.
So I notice they're starting to separate.
Sure, it means there's a limit to the accuracy of this particular simulation, and eventually those things will differ from each other. I mean, it's also the case, remember, that these critical solutions are unstable. They have this one unstable growing mode, which is the thing that leads to gravitational collapse or dispersal. And so you sort of try to tune as closely as you possibly can to the critical solution, but you're always off by a little bit, and that little bit is going to grow exponentially. So, I mean, if for example, I was, you know, comparing the same system but with slightly different values of the critical parameter, things would sort of look like this. They would track for a while, but the one that's slightly different would separate from the other one. So this separation is real, and it's due to, you know, the fact that we don't have either perfect accuracy in the numerical codes or perfect accuracy in tuning to the critical solution. Okay, so now let me tell you the resolution of the paradox. So what we've seen from the numerics is that somehow or other, this critical collapse of a massive vector field is the same as the critical collapse of a massless scalar field. So how can that be? Well, in particular, let's consider the following ansatz for the form of the vector field in the mass goes to zero limit. So instead of assuming that in the mass goes to zero limit, we have a nice smooth vector field, let's assume that the vector field has the form 1 over mass times some vector p plus mass times some vector q plus things that are higher order in mass. So at first sight, you would think, well, gee, this looks crazy. The vector field is going singular. And if the vector field goes singular, this is surely going to give rise to a singular stress energy. And so you won't get anything nice in the limit. Well, it turns out that if you write out the stress energy for a massive vector field, there are two pieces to it. One depends on the vector field squared, but those things have a mu squared in front of them, and so that will cancel this out, so those things don't go singular. And the other thing depends on the field strength, which depends on the curl of A. So that is indeed threatening to be singular, but you can prevent that from happening just by making this P curl free. So to get a non-singular stress energy and the mass goes to zero limit, you need P to be curl-free, and so there must be some scalar phi so that P is the gradient of phi. When you then assume that, A of the form 1 over mu times grad phi plus mu times q plus dot, 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 what you find is that the mass goes to zero limit of the stress energy does exist, and it's identical to the stress energy of the scalar field. So this is what's going on. What's going on is that we are indeed seeing the vector field in the mass goes to zero limit, but that mass goes to zero limit is not what we thought it was. It's something that sort of looks singular, but actually ends up just picking out the mass, the stress energy of a massless scalar field phi.
Have you not left out the mu to the zero because you're not interested in it?
Well, so I'm assuming an ansatz of this form. There's still the question of why the vector field has this form in the mass goes to zero limit.
Well, you get a massless scalar field plus a maximum field?
Well, I mean, the Maxwell field in spherical symmetry won't really make a difference. Let's see. So we only ran our simulations in spherical symmetry, and you only get the paradox in spherical symmetry, because in spherical symmetry, the Maxwell part has to be absent. I'm not really sure what would happen if you don't have spherical symmetry. If you don't have spherical symmetry, we don't have the paradox, and there could easily be some other critical solution, because the Maxwell field will have degrees of freedom of its own.
But here, you won't take the limit of critical
collapse,
you were saying the limit mu goes to zero.
Right.
These are independent from the simulation.
Well, it's not quite independent. So the simulations show that, in fact, the simulations do, in fact, show that, in some sense, the mass is negligible because we're going to this massless scalar field. And then the question is, how can it be that in that with the mass going to zero, we actually recover a scalar field, not a vector field? And the answer is, if you somehow assume this ansatz for how things behave in the mass goes to zero limit, then it comes out naturally, without regard to the questions of the symmetry, that the mass goes to zero limit of a massive vector field is a massless scalar field.
That scalar field might say is the sort of gauge mode if you're trying to interpret it.
Right.
But I mean, normally that's, in Maxwell theory, that's not part of the physics, but in this mass, even if you put mu equals zero in the original field equation, you have that degree of freedom, right? So
that's correct.
The real difference between the problems.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in more physical terms and sort of in the language of particle physics, what's going on is that the massive vector field has, in addition to the transverse degrees of freedom, some longitudinal degrees of freedom. And for a Maxwell field, that longitudinal degree of freedom can just be gauged away, as Vince says, but here it's actually physical, and it turns out that what's going on is that in critical collapse, it's that extra longitudinal degree of freedom that's responsible for the critical collapse, and it's that extra longitudinal degree of freedom is equivalent to a scalar field and is giving rise to massless scalar field critical collapse. So that's essentially the resolution of the paradox. The resolution of the paradox is there really is this extra degree of freedom, and that extra degree of freedom dominates in the critical collapse limit.
I think it would work for, say, an extra
Well, let's see. So I thought there were, you know, hideous inconsistencies with higher spin fields, and even for a spin 2 field, unless it is gravity. So I'm not quite sure how to do that. I mean, if you figure out how to do it, we can try running the simulations. But I thought there's a standard result that such things are inconsistent. Well, right. So that's yet another possibility. Yeah, and then I'm not quite sure what the answer is. Okay. So anyway, that's all I had to say. Thank you.